or criticism, no doubt reserving to himself the right of playing the part of the avenger of Christianity when the work should have appeared. He resealed the manuscript and sent it to Ray. Such was essentially the story which he told me in the letter in which he gave me an account of the matter, and that is all that I've heard about it. Besides these two works and my Dictionnaire de Musique, at which I worked from time to time, I had some other writings of less importance, all ready for publication, which I intended to bring out, either separately or in a general collection of my works, if I ever undertook to produce one. The most important of these, most of which are still in manuscript in the hands of Dupayot, was an Essai sur l'origine des langues, which I had read to Monsieur de Malesherbes and the Chevalier de Lorenzi, who expressed his approval of it. I calculated that all these works together, after all expenses, would be worth to me at least 8,000 or 10,000 francs, which I intended to sink in a life annuity for myself and Thérèse. After this, we would go and live together in the corner of some province, where I would no longer trouble the public with myself, or trouble myself about anything further, except how to end my days peacefully, while continuing to do as much good around me as was possible, and to write at my leisure the memoirs which I meditated. Such was my scheme, the execution of which was rendered still easier to me by the generosity of Ray, which I must not pass by in silence. This publisher, of whom I heard so much that was bad at Paris, is nevertheless the only one, of all those with whom I have had anything to do, that I have always had reason to be satisfied with. When I wrote these lines, I was far from imagining or conceiving, much less believing, the frauds which I subsequently discovered in the printing of my works, which he was obliged to admit. We certainly often quarrelled about the publication of my books. He was careless, and I was hasty. But in financial matters and others connected with them, although I never had a regular agreement with him, I always found him strictly honourable. He is also the only one who has openly admitted that he made a good thing out of me, and he has often told me that he owed his fortune to me, and offered to share it with me. Being unable to show his gratitude to myself directly, he desired to prove it at least in the person of my better half, upon whom he settled an annuity of 300 francs, stating in the deed that it was an acknowledgment of the advantages he owed to me. We settled the matter between us, without any show or pretentiousness, and if I had not been the first to let everybody know of it, no one would ever have heard of it. I was so affected by his behaviour that from that I became sincerely attached to him. Sometime afterwards he asked me to stand godfather to one of his children. I consented. And one of my regrets, in the condition to which I have been reduced, is that I have been deprived of all opportunity of ever making my attachment of any service to my goddaughter and her parents. How is it that I, who am so grateful for the modest generosity of this publisher, feel so little gratitude for the noisy attentions of so many distinguished personages, who boastfully fill the world with an account of the benefits which they claim to have bestowed upon me, the results of which I have never felt? Is it their fault or is it mine? Is it merely vanity on their part or ungratefulness on mine? I ask the intelligent reader to consider and decide the matter. For myself I am dumb. This pension was a great assistance to Thérèse and a great relief for me, but I was far from desiring any direct profit for myself from it, any more than from any other presents which she received. She has always had the absolute disposal of it. If I kept her money, I rendered her a faithful account of it, without ever deducting a farthing for our common expenses, even when she was better off than I was. "That which is mine is ours," I said to her, "and that which is yours." I always behaved in money matters in accordance with this principle, which I often repeated to her. Those who are base enough to accuse me of accepting through her hands what I refused to accept with my own, no doubt judged my heart by their own, and had but little knowledge of me. I would gladly eat with her the bread she may earn, but never that which may be given to her. I appeal to her own testimony on this point, both now and hereafter, when, in the course of nature, she shall have survived me. Unfortunately, she knows little about economy and anything, and she is careless and extravagant, not from vanity or fondness of delicacies, but from sheer thoughtlessness. No one is perfect in this world, and since her excellent qualities must be counterbalanced, I prefer that she should have faults rather than vices, although these faults are sometimes more prejudicial to us both. The efforts which I have made for her sake, as formerly for Mamma's, to put by a little hoard which might some day be useful to her, are inconceivable. But it has always been labour lost. Neither of them ever reckoned with herself, and in spite of all my endeavours, all that I earned was immediately gone. Notwithstanding the simplicity with which she dresses, Ray's pension has never been sufficient, and I've always been obliged to assist her every year. Neither she nor I was born to be rich, and I certainly do not reckon that as one of our misfortunes. The Contrat Social was printed with little delay. It was different with Emile, for the publication of which I was obliged to wait before I could carry out my project of retirement. From time to time, Duchesne sent me specimens of type to choose from, and after I'd made a choice, instead of putting the work in hand, he sent me fresh ones. When we had at last settled upon the size and type, and several sheets had already been struck off in consequence of a slight alteration which I made in a proof he began all over again, and at the end of 6 months we were not so advanced as on the first day. While these experiments were going on, I discovered that the book was being printed in France as well as in Holland, and in two separate editions. What could I do? The manuscript was no longer under my control. Far from having anything to do with the French edition, I had always opposed it. But at length, since it was being brought out, whether I liked it or not, and served as a model for the other, I was obliged to glance over it and look at the proofs, to prevent my work being mutilated and disfigured. Besides, the work was being printed with such definite approval on the part of the magistrate that the undertaking was in some sort under his direction. He frequently wrote to me, and even came to see me on the subject, on a certain occasion of which I will speak presently. While Duchesne proceeded at a tortoise pace, Neulm, whom he kept back, proceeded even still more slowly. The sheets were not sent to him regularly as they were printed. He thought that Duchesne, that is to say, de Guy, who acted for him, was not behaving in good faith. And seeing that the agreement was not being carried out, he wrote to me letter after letter full of complaints and grievances, which I could no more remedy than my own. His friend, Guérin, who at that time saw me pretty frequently, was always talking to me about the book, but with the greatest reserve. He did, and he did not know that it was being printed in France. He did, and he did not know that the magistrate was interesting himself in it. He sympathized with me upon the embarrassment the book would cause me, while at the same time he seemed to accuse me of imprudence, without ever telling me in what it consisted. He equivocated and shuffled incessantly. He seemed to talk only to make me talk. At that time I fancied myself so secure that I laughed at the cautious and mysterious tone which he adopted in the matter, as a habit contracted by constant intercourse with ministerial and magisterial offices. Feeling sure that everything concerned with the work was in order, firmly convinced that it enjoyed not only the approval and protection of the magistrate, but even deserved and had obtained the favour of the ministry, I congratulated myself upon my courage in acting rightly, and laughed at the faint-heartedness of my friends, who seemed anxious about me. Duclos was amongst the number, and I confess that my confidence in his uprightness and shrewdness might have alarmed me, if I had felt less confidence in the usefulness of the work and the honour of its patrons. He came to see me on the part of Monsieur Bailly, while Emile was in the press, and spoke to me about it. I read to him the Savoyard Vicar's Profession of Faith. He listened to it quietly, and, as it seemed to me, with great pleasure. When I had finished, he said to me, "What, citizen, is this part of a book which is being printed in Paris?" "Yes," I answered, "and it was to be printed at the Louvre, by order of the King." "I admit it," said he, "but be kind enough not to tell anyone that you have read me this extract." This singular way of expressing himself surprised, but did not alarm me. I knew that Duclos saw a good deal of Monsieur de Malesherbes, and I found it difficult to understand how he could hold so different an opinion in regard to the same thing. I had lived at Montmorency for more than 4 years, without having enjoyed one single day of good health. Although the air is excellent, the water is bad, and this may very well have been one of the causes which aggravated my usual complaints. About the end of the autumn of 1761 I fell seriously ill and spent the whole winter in almost constant suffering. My physical ailments, increased by numerous uneasinesses, made them still more painful to me. For some time secret and gloomy forebodings had been disturbing me, although I did not know to what they referred. I received several curious anonymous letters, and even signed ones which were equally curious, one from a councillor of the Parliament of Paris, who, dissatisfied with the present constitution of affairs, and prognosticating no good from its results, wished to consult me as to the choice of an asylum in Geneva or Switzerland, to which he and his family might retire. Another from Monsieur de Blanc, President Armortier in the Parliament of Blanc, who proposed to me to draw up a memorandum and remonstrances for this Parliament, which at that time was out of favour with the court, at the same time offering to supply me with all the materials and documents which I might require. When I am suffering, I am easily irritated. This was what happened when I received these letters, and I showed it by my answers, in which I flatly refused to do what I was asked. I certainly do not reproach myself for refusing, since these letters might have been snares set for me by my enemies. For instance, I knew that the president of Blank was intimately connected with the encyclopedists and the Olbachians. And what I was asked to do was opposed to the principles from which I was still less than ever inclined to depart. But when I might have refused politely, I refused rudely, and therefore in that I was wrong. The two letters of which I have just spoken will be found amongst my papers. The letter from the councillor did not altogether surprise me, because, in common with him and many others, I thought that the break-up of the constitution threatened France with speedy destruction. The disasters of an unfortunate war, which were all the fault of the government. This was the 7 Years' War. The incredible financial disorders, the continued disagreements in the administration, which had hitherto been conducted by 2 or 3 ministers openly opposed, and who, in order to injure each other, were running the kingdom. The general discontent of the people and of all classes in the state. The stubbornness of an obstinate woman who, ever sacrificing her intellectual powers, if she possessed any, to her inclinations, almost invariably kept the most capable men out of offices, in order to fill them with those who were her favourites. All these things contributed to justify the forebodings of the councillor, the public, and myself. These forebodings several times made me consider whether I should not act wisely in seeking a refuge for myself outside the kingdom, before the troubles, which seemed to threaten it, broke out. But, reassured by my insignificance and peaceful disposition, I believed that, in the retirement in which I intended to live, no storm could reach me. My only regret was that, when things were in this condition, Monsieur de Luxembourg undertook commissions which could not fail to make him disliked in his government. I could have wished him to prepare a retreat for himself there, ready for all emergencies, in case the great machine should fall to pieces, which there seemed reason to fear under existing circumstances. And it still seems to me at the present time that there can be no doubt that, if the reins of government had not fallen completely into the hands of one man, the French monarchy would now be in its last agonies. While my condition grew worse, the printing of Émile proceeded more slowly, and was at last entirely suspended. I was unable to learn the reason. Guy did not condescend either to write to me again or to answer my letters. I could not procure information from anyone, and knew nothing of what was going on, Monsieur de Malesherbes being in the country at the time. No misfortune, whatever it may be, ever troubles or overwhelms me, provided that I know in what it consists. but I am naturally afraid of darkness. I dread and hate its gloomy appearance. Mystery always makes me uneasy. It is too much opposed to my disposition, which is frank, to the verge of imprudence. During the daytime, the sight of the most hideous monster would, I believe, alarm me but little. But if I were to see by night a figure in a white sheet, I should be afraid. Thus my fancy, kindled by this prolonged silence, busied itself in conjuring up for me a number of phantoms. The more I had at heart the publication of my last and best work, the more I tormented myself to find out what could be delaying it. And, as I always went to extremes in everything, I saw in the suspension of the printing the suppression of the book. Meanwhile, as I was unable to imagine the reason or the manner of this interruption, I remained a prey to the most cruel uncertainty. I wrote letter after letter to Guy, Monsieur de Malesherbes, and Madame de Luxembourg, and as no answers came at all, or did not come when I expected them, I was utterly confused and almost beside myself. Unfortunately, I heard, at the same time, that Father Griffet, a Jesuit, had spoken of Emile, and had even quoted passages from it. In a moment, my imagination, like a flash of lightning, disclosed the whole iniquitous mystery. I saw its progress as clearly and as surely as if it had been revealed to me. I imagined that the Jesuits, furious at the tone of contempt in which I had spoken of their colleges, had got possession of my work, that it was they who were delaying its publication, that, having been informed by their friend Guérin of my present condition, and foreseeing my speedy death, of which I myself entertain no doubt, their object was to delay the printing until that event occurred, with the intention of mutilating and altering the work, and, in order to serve their own ends, of attributing to me opinions totally different from my own. It is astonishing what a crowd of facts and circumstances entered my head to accommodate themselves to this mad idea, and to give it an air of probability, nay, to prove and demonstrate its truth. I knew that Guérin was completely devoted to the Jesuits. I attributed to them all the friendly advances which he had made to me. I persuaded myself that it was at their instigation that he had urged me to enter into negotiations with Naum, that it was through the latter that they had got hold of the first sheets of my work, and that they had subsequently found means to make Duchesne stop printing, and perhaps to get possession of my manuscript, in order to work upon it at their leisure, until my death should leave them free to publish their travesty of it. I had always felt, in spite of Father Berthier's show of affection, that the Jesuits had no love for me, not only as being an encyclopedist, but also because my views were even more hostile to their principles and influence than the unbelief of my colleagues. Since atheistic and religious fanaticism, which approach closely in their common intolerance, are even capable of uniting, as they have done in China, and as they do now against myself. Whereas rational and moral religion, which takes away all human control over the conscience, deprives of further resource those who claim that power. I knew that the Chancellor also was a great friend of the Jesuits. I was afraid that the son, intimidated by the father, might find himself compelled to abandon to them the manuscript which he had taken under his protection. I even imagined that I could see the effect of this abandonment in the chicanery which was stirred up against me, in regard to the two first volumes, in which fresh sheets were required for mere trifles. While the two remaining volumes, as was well known, were full of such outspoken sentiments, that it would have been necessary to recast them entirely, if they had been criticised by the censor like the two first. I knew besides, and Monsieur de Malesherbes himself told me, that the Abbé de Grave, who had been charged with the inspection of this edition, was another partisan of the Jesuits. I saw nothing but Jesuits everywhere, without reflecting that they, on the eve of their annihilation, and fully occupied with their own defence, had something else to do than to intrigue against the printing of a book in which they were not concerned. I am wrong, however, in saying, without reflection. I certainly did think of it. Monsieur de Malesherbes himself even took care to make the objection as soon as he heard of my fantastic idea. But owing to another of these caprices to which a man is subject who attempts, in the bosom of obscurity, to judge of secret and important affairs of which he knows nothing, I refused to believe that the Jesuits were in danger, and I regarded such rumours as a ruse on their part to lull their adversaries to sleep. Their past and ever-consistent successes gave me so terrible an idea of their power that I already lamented the degradation of the Parliament. I knew that Monsieur de Choiseul had studied among the Jesuits, that Madame de Pompadour was not on bad terms with them, and that their league with the favourites and ministers had always been considered of great service to both parties against their common enemies. The court appeared to be neutral, and feeling convinced that if the society one day met with a severe check, the Parliament would never be strong enough to give it, I drew from this inaction on the part of the court the justification of their confidence and the augury of their triumph. In short, seeing in all the rumours of the day nothing but a feint and snares on their part, and believing that, in their position of security, they had time to attend to everything, I had no doubt that they would soon crush Jansenism, the Parliament, the encyclopedists, and all who had not submitted to their yoke, and that, if they permitted my book to appear, it would not be until they had transformed it into a weapon for themselves, by making use of my name in order to deceive my readers. I felt that I was dying. I can scarcely understand how it was that my extravagant notions did not prove my death blow, so terribly was I alarmed at the idea that my memory would be dishonoured in a work which was my best and most worthy of me. I never felt such dread of death, and I believe that if I had died then, I should have died in a state of utter despair. Even at the present day, when I see the blackest and most hideous conspiracy which has ever been entered into against a man's memory, advancing without hindrance to its accomplishment, I shall die much more peacefully, feeling sure of leaving behind me in my writings a witness in my favour which, sooner or later, will triumph over the conspiracies of men. 1762. Monsieur de Malesherbes, the witness and confidant of my agitation, did his utmost to calm it in a manner which proved his inexhaustible goodness of heart. Monsieur de Luxembourg assisted in this good work and went to see Duchesne several times in order to find out how the edition was progressing. At last the printing was resumed and proceeded more rapidly, and I have never known why it had been suspended. Monsieur de Malesherbes took the trouble to come to Montmorency to calm my agitation, and he succeeded. My perfect confidence in his uprightness, having overcome the derangement of my poor head, rendered effectual every effort on his part to restore its equilibrium. After what he had seen of my distress and frenzy, it was natural that he should consider that I greatly deserved to be pitied. The talk of the philosophic cabal by which he was surrounded, repeated over and over again, came back to his mind. When I went to live at the Hermitage, they publicly declared, as I have already said, that I should not be able to stand it long. When they saw that I persevered, they said that it was due to obstinacy, pride, and shame at the idea of giving in, but that I was really wearied to death and was very unhappy. Monsieur de Malesherbes believed it and wrote to me, feeling deeply this mistake on the part of a man whom I so highly esteemed. I wrote to him four letters, one after the other, in which I explained the true reasons for my conduct, and at the same time faithfully described my tastes, my character, and all the feelings of my inmost heart. These four letters, written off-hand, hurriedly, with a single stroke of the pen, and which I never even read over, are perhaps the only compositions which I have ever written with perfect ease during the whole of my life. And what is even more astonishing, at a time when I was suffering deeply and was in a state of the utmost depression. Feeling my strength giving way, I sighed at the thought that I was leaving behind, in the minds of honourable men, so unjust an opinion of myself. And by means of the sketch hastily thrown off in these four letters, I attempted, in some degree, to supply the place of the memoirs which I had proposed to write. These letters, which pleased Monsieur de Malesherbes, and which he showed to people in Paris, are to a certain extent the summary of that which I here set forth in detail, and on this ground are worthy of being preserved. The copy of them, which he had made at my request, and which he sent me some years afterwards, will be found amongst my papers. From that time the only thing which troubled me when I thought of my approaching death was the want of a literary friend whom I could trust, in whose hands I could deposit my papers, so that after my death he might pick and choose from them. After my journey to Geneva, I had become friendly with Moultou. I was fond of this young man and should have liked him to close my eyes. I told him of my desire, and I believed that he would have performed this act of humanity with pleasure, if his affairs and his family had permitted him. Deprived of this consolation, I wished at least to give him a proof of my confidence by sending him the Savoyard Vicar's Profession of Faith before it was published. He was very pleased with it, but from the tone of his reply he did not appear to me to share the feeling of confidence with which at that time I awaited its effect. He expressed a wish to have something of mine which no one else possessed. I sent him a funeral oration upon the late Duke of Orléans, which I had written for the Abbé Dati, but which had not been delivered because, contrary to his expectation, that duty had not been entrusted to him. The printing, when it had once been resumed, was quietly continued and finished, and I noticed as a singular fact that after the fresh sheets, which had been stringently exacted for the first two volumes, the last two were passed without a word, and no objection of any kind was taken to their contents. However, I still felt an uneasiness, which I must not omit to mention. After having been alarmed at the Jesuits, I became alarmed at the Jansenists and philosophers. An enemy to everything that comes under the denomination of party, faction, and cabal, I have never expected any good from those who belong to them. The gossips had left their former abode some time ago, and had established themselves so close to me that from their room it was possible to hear everything that was said, either in mine or on my terrace, and it was perfectly easy to climb from their garden the low wall which separated it from my turret. I had made this turret my study, and in it there was a table covered with proofs and sheets of Émile and the Contrat Social. These sheets I stitched together as they were sent to me, and thus had complete copies of all the volumes long before they were published. My thoughtlessness, carelessness, and confidence in Monsieur Matard, in the garden by which I was enclosed, often made me forget to shut my turret at night, and in the morning I found it wide open. This would not have caused me the least uneasiness had I not fancied that I noticed that my papers had been disturbed. Having noticed this several times, I became more careful about shutting the turret. The lock was bad, and the key would only turn halfway in it. A more careful examination showed me that my papers were disturbed even more than when I left the door wide open. At last, one of my volumes disappeared for a day and two nights, and I was utterly unable to find what had become of it until the morning of the third day, when I found it on my table again. I neither felt then, nor ever have felt, any suspicion of Monsieur Matard or his nephew, Monsieur Dumoulin, as I know that both had a sincere regard for me, and I felt every confidence in them. I began to feel less sure about the gossips. I knew that, although they were Jansenists, they had some connection with D'Alembert and lived in the same house. This caused me some uneasiness and made me more careful. I removed my papers to my room, and entirely gave up visiting these people, as I had also heard that they had exhibited in several houses the first volume of Émile, which I had been imprudent enough to lend them. Although they continued to be my neighbours until I left, I held no further communication with them from that time forth. The Contrat Social appeared a month or two before Émile. Ray, whom I'd made promise never to introduce any of my books secretly into France, applied to the magistrate for permission to introduce this by way of Rouen, to which place he sent his consignments by sea. He received no reply. His packages remained at Rouen for several months. When they were sent back to him, after an attempt had been made to confiscate them. But he created such a disturbance that they were returned to him. Certain persons, out of curiosity, procured some copies from Amsterdam, which circulated without making much stir. Moléon, who had heard and even seen something of this, spoke to me about it with an air of mystery which surprised me, and would even have made me uneasy, unless, feeling sure that I'd acted in order in everything, and had done nothing with which I could reproach myself, I had reassured myself by my grand principle. I entertained no doubt that Monsieur de Choiseul, who had already shown himself favourably disposed towards me, and appreciated the eulogy which my esteem had caused me to pronounce upon him in this work, would support me on this occasion against the ill will of Madame de Pompadour. At that time I certainly had as much reason as ever to reckon upon the kindness of Monsieur de Luxembourg, and his support in case of necessity, for he never gave me more frequent or more touching proofs of his friendship. During his Easter visit, my melancholy state of health did not allow me to go to the chateau, but he never let a day pass without paying me a visit, and seeing that my sufferings were incessant, he at last persuaded me to let him send for Brother Combe. Jean Bazaillac, 1703-1781, a great authority on stone and diseases of the bladder. He was a member of the religious order founded by Robert de Molem in the village of Citeaux in 1098. He brought him to me himself, and had the courage, certainly rare and meritorious in a great nobleman, to remain with me during the operation, which was a long and painful one. However, it was only a question of being probed, but I had never been able to submit to it, even at the hands of Morand, who made the attempt several times, but always unsuccessfully. Brother Combe, whose skill and lightness of hand was unequalled, at last succeeded in introducing a very small probe, after having caused me great suffering for more than 2 hours, during which I did my utmost to restrain my cries, to avoid distressing the tender-hearted Marquis. On the first examination, Brother Combe thought he had discovered a large stone, and told me so. On the second, he could not find it. After having made a second and third examination with a care and exactitude which made the time seem very long, he declared that there was no stone at all, but that the prostate gland was serous and abnormally swollen. He found the bladder large and in good condition, and he ended by expressing his opinion that I should suffer greatly, and that I should live for a long time. If the second prediction is filled as completely as the first, my sufferings are not nearly at an end. Thus, after having been successively treated for so many years for complaints which I never had, I ended by learning that my malady, incurable without being fatal, would last as long as myself. My imagination, checked by this knowledge, no longer presented to me the prospect of a cruel death in the agonies of stone. I ceased to fear that the end of a bogie, which had long ago been broken off in the urethra, had laid the foundation for the formation of a stone. Freed from imaginary evils, more cruel than those which were real, I endured the latter more patiently. There is no doubt that, since that time, I have suffered much less from my malady than I had ever done before, and I never remember that I owe this relief to Monsieur de Luxembourg without being stirred to fresh emotion when I think of him. Thus restored, so to speak, to life, and more than ever occupied with my plans for passing what still remained of it, I only waited for the publication of Émile in order to put them into execution. I thought of Touraine, which I had already visited, and which pleased me greatly, owing to the mildness of its climate, and the gentleness of its inhabitants. La terra molle e lieta e dilettosa, simile a se gli abitator produce. The country, agreeable, fertile, and delightful, produces inhabitants like itself. I had already mentioned my plan to Monsieur de Luxembourg, who endeavoured to dissuade me from it. I spoke to him of it again, as a step upon which I had decided. He then proposed to me the Chateau of Merlu, 15 leagues from Paris, as a refuge which might possibly suit me, where he and his wife would be delighted to see me settled. The proposal touched me and made a favourable impression upon my mind. First of all, it was necessary to see the place, and we agreed that he should send his valet de chambre with a carriage, on a day which was fixed upon, to drive me there. On that day I was very unwell, the journey had to be put off, and various disappointments prevented the plan from being carried out. As I subsequently heard that Merlu belonged not to Monsieur de Luxembourg but to his wife, I had less difficulty in consoling myself for not having gone there. Emile at last appeared, without my having heard any more about fresh proofs or other difficulties. Before its publication, Monsieur de Luxembourg asked me to return all the letters from Monsieur de Malesherbes, which had reference to the work. My great confidence in both, my feeling of perfect security, prevented me from considering the extraordinary and even alarming aspect of this request. I gave up the letters, with the exception of one or two, which had inadvertently been left in some books. Some time previously, Monsieur de Malesherbes had observed to me that he would withdraw the letters which I had written to Duchesne at the time when I was alarmed about the Jesuits. And I must confess that these letters were not very creditable to my intelligence. But I told him that I was not desirous of appearing better in any respect than I really was, and that he might leave the letters with Duchesne. I do not know whether he did so. The publication of this book did not take place with the outburst of approval which had followed that of all my other writings. Never did a work meet with such praise from private individuals, and so little approbation from the public. What those who were most capable of judging said and wrote to me about it confirmed me in the opinion that it was the best, as well as the most important, of my writings. But all this was told me with the most curious circumspection, as if it had been a matter of importance to keep all favourable opinion of it secret. Madame de Boufflers, who declared to me that the author of such a work deserved statues and the homage of all mankind, without any ceremony begged me, at the end of her note, to send it back to her. D'Alembert, who wrote to me to the effect that the work decided my superiority, and was bound to place me at the head of all men of letters, did not sign his note, although he had signed all those which he had previously written to me. Duclos, a friend on whom I could depend, an upright but cautious man, and who thought highly of the work, avoided expressing any opinion of it in writing. La Condamine fell upon the profession of faith, and beat about the bush. Clairaut, in his letter, confined himself to the same part of the book, but was not afraid to declare how greatly he had been touched by reading it. He told me, in so many words, that the perusal of it had warmed his old soul. Of all those to whom I sent my book, he was the only one who told the world, openly and unreservedly, how highly he thought of it. Matard, to whom I'd also given a copy before it was on sale, lent it to Monsieur Blair, parliamentary councillor, and father of the Intendant of Strasbourg. Monsieur de Blair had a country house at Saint-Gratien, and Matard, who was an old acquaintance, sometimes went to see him when he was able. He made him read Emile before it came out. Monsieur de Blair, on giving it back to him, made the following remark, which was repeated to me on the same day. Monsieur Matard, this is a very fine book, but it will soon be spoken of more than is desirable for the author. When he repeated this to me, I merely laughed and saw nothing more in it than the self-importance of a magistrate who makes a mystery of everything. All the disturbing expressions which were repeated to me made equally little impression upon me, and, far from foreseeing in the least the catastrophe which was close at hand, convinced of the beauty and usefulness of my work, certain that I was in order in all respects, sure, as I believed I had a right to be, of all the influence of Madame de Luxembourg, and even of the favour of ministers, I congratulated myself upon the resolution which I had taken, to retire in the midst of my triumphs, and when I had just crushed all those who were jealous of me. One thing alone alarmed me in regard to the publication of the work, not so much out of consideration of my own safety, as from a desire to quiet my conscience. At the Hermitage and at Montmorency, close to my doors, I had seen with indignation the vexatious annoyances inflicted, owing to the jealous care with which the pleasures of princes are guarded, upon the unfortunate peasants, who are obliged to put up with the damage caused to their fields by the game, not venturing to protect themselves further than by making a noise, and compelled to spend the nights amidst their beans and peas, beating kettles, drums, and bells, to keep off the wild boars. A witness of the barbarous severity with which Monsieur le Comte de Charolois caused these poor people to be treated, I had made an attack upon this cruel behaviour towards the end of Emile. This was another violation of my principles, which has not remained unpunished. I heard that the officers of Monsieur le Prince de Conti treated the peasants upon his estates with hardly less cruelty. I trembled for fear that this prince, towards whom I entertained the deepest feelings of respect and gratitude, might apply to himself the attack which a feeling of revolted humanity had caused me to make upon his uncle, and be offended at it. However, as my conscience completely justified me on this point, I quieted myself by its testimony, and I was right. At least, I have never heard that this great prince paid the slightest attention to this passage, which was written long before I had the honour of his acquaintance. A few days before, or after, the publication of my book, I do not exactly remember the time, another work on the same subject appeared, taken word for word from my first volume, with the exception of a few platitudes scattered over the extract. This book bore the name of a Genovese named Balaxer, and according to the title it had gained the prize at the Harlem Academy. I easily understood that this academy and this prize had been quite recently founded in order to disguise the plagiarism in the eyes of the public. But I also saw that there must have been some previous intriguing, which I was at a loss to understand, either through the communication of my manuscript, without which the theft would have been impossible, or for the purpose of establishing the story of this pretended prize, for which it had been necessary to find some foundation. It was not until several years afterwards that I penetrated the mystery, in consequence of a word which Duvernoy let fall, and saw, as it were between the lines, who it was that had drawn Monsieur Balaxer into the affair. The dull murmur which precedes the storm began to make itself heard. All keen-witted persons saw clearly that, in regard to my book and myself, some plot was brewing, which would soon explode. As for me, my feeling of security and stupidity were so great that, far from having any idea of my misfortune, I did not even suspect the cause, after I had felt the effects of it. My opponents began by cleverly spreading the idea that, while the Jesuits were severely treated, no favouritism could be shown towards books and authors who attacked religion. I was reproached for having put my name to Emile, as if I had not put it to all my other writings, against which nothing had been said. It seemed as if people were afraid of being forced to take certain steps which they would regret, but which circumstances rendered necessary, and to which my imprudence had given occasion. These rumours reached my ears, but caused me scarcely any uneasiness. It never even occurred to me that in the whole affair there could be anything which personally affected me. Me, who felt myself so completely beyond reproach, so strongly supported, and so entirely in order in all respects, and who had no fear that Madame de Luxembourg would leave me in difficulties on account of an error, which, if it had been committed, was entirely due to her. But, as I knew the usual course of things in similar cases, that it is the custom to rage against the booksellers while the authors are spared, I was not without some uneasiness in regard to poor Duchesne, if Monsieur de Malesherbes should abandon him. I remained calm. The rumours increased, and soon assumed a different character. The public, and above all the Parliament, appeared irritated by my calmness. At the end of a few days, the excitement became terrible. The threats changed their object, and were addressed directly to myself. Members of Parliament might be heard saying quite openly that it was no good to burn the books, that the authors ought to be burnt as well. As for the booksellers, not a word was said about them. The first time that these expressions of opinion, more worthy of an inquisitor of Goa than of a senator, were repeated to me, I had no doubt that they were an invention of the Olbakians intended to frighten me and drive me out of the country. I laughed at this childish trick, and said to myself that if they had known the real state of things, they would have sought some other means of frightening me. But at length the rumour became so pronounced that it was clear that it was serious. Monsieur and Madame de Luxembourg had made their second visit to Montmorency somewhat earlier than usual this year, and were there at the beginning of June. I heard very little said about my new books, in spite of the stir which they created in Paris, and neither Monsieur nor Madame de Luxembourg said a word to me on the matter. One morning, however, when I was alone with Monsieur de Luxembourg, he asked me, "Have you said anything against Monsieur de Choiseul in the Contrat Social?" Starting back with surprise, I replied, "I? No, certainly not. That I swear to you. On the contrary, I have pronounced upon him, with a pen which is not given to flattery, the most splendid eulogy that a minister has ever received." With that, I quoted the whole passage to him. "And in Emile?" he went on to ask. "Not a word," I answered. "There is not even a single word in it which refers to him." "Ah," said he, with more vivacity than usual, "you ought to have done the same thing in the other book, or to have made yourself clearer." "I thought that I had done so," I answered. "I esteemed him highly enough for that." He was on the point of speaking again. I saw that he was ready to unbosom himself, but he checked himself and remained silent. Oh, the misery of a courtier's diplomacy, which, even in the best of hearts, overpowers friendship itself. This conversation, although brief, enlightened me upon my situation, at least, in regard to certain things, and made me understand that it was certainly I who was attacked. I deplored this unheard-of fatality, which turned to my disadvantage all the good that I said and did. However, believing that I had Madame de Luxembourg and Monsieur de Malesherbes to protect me in this matter, I did not see how it would be possible for my enemies to thrust them aside and reach me. For, in addition, I felt from that moment that it would no longer be a question of equity and justice, and that no one would trouble himself to examine whether I was really right or wrong. However, the storm roared louder and louder. Even Naon himself, in his wearisome chatter, showed me how greatly he regretted having had anything to do with this work, and the certainty which he seemed to entertain of the fate which threatened both the book and its author. One thing, however, still comforted me. I found Madame de Luxembourg so calm, so contented, so cheerful even, that she must have known what she was about, since she did not show the least anxiety on my account, did not utter a word of sympathy or apology, and regarded the turn the affair was taking with as much coolness as if she had nothing to do with it, and had never taken the least interest in myself. The only thing that surprised me was that she said nothing at all to me. It appeared to me that she ought to have said something. Madame de Boufflers seemed more uneasy. She came to and fro in an agitated manner, showed great activity, assured me that Monsieur le Prince de Conti was also exerting himself to ward off the blow which was being prepared for me, and which she attributed simply to the present state of affairs, in which it was of importance to the Parliament not to give the Jesuits an opportunity of accusing it of indifference in religious matters. She seemed, however, to have little confidence in the success of the prince's efforts or her own. The drift of all her conversations, which were more alarming than reassuring, was the same: to induce me to leave the country and retire to England, where she offered to find me several friends, amongst others the celebrated Hume, with whom she had long been acquainted. Seeing that I persisted in remaining calm, she adopted a line which was more calculated to shake my resolution. She gave me to understand that if I was arrested and examined, I should be obliged to mention Madame de Luxembourg, and that her friendship for me certainly deserved that I should not expose myself to the danger of being forced to compromise her. I replied that she might make herself easy, and that in such a case I would certainly not compromise her. She answered that such a resolution was easier to take than to keep. And in this she was right, especially in my case, since I was quite determined never to perjure myself or speak falsely before the judges, whatever risk there might be in telling the truth. Seeing that, although this observation had made a certain impression upon me, I could not yet bring myself to decide upon flight, she spoke to me of the Bastille for a few weeks as a means of escaping from the jurisdiction of the Parliament, which does not interfere with state prisoners. I made no objection to this singular favour, provided that it was not solicited in my name. As she said no more about it, I afterwards assumed that she'd only proposed the idea in order to try me, and that an expedient which would have put an end to everything was not desired. A few days afterwards, Monsieur le Maréchal received from the curé of Deuilly, a friend of Grimm and Madame d'Épinay, a letter containing the information, which he declared came from a trustworthy source, that the Parliament intended to proceed against me with extreme severity, and that, on a certain day, which he mentioned, a warrant would be issued for my apprehension. I regarded this as an invention on the part of the Olbakians. I knew that the Parliament paid great attention to forms, and that it would be an infringement of them all, to commence on this occasion with a warrant of arrest, before it had been judicially established whether I acknowledged the book and was really its author. I said to Madame de Boufflers, "It is only in the case of those crimes which disturb the public safety that a warrant is issued upon a simple information for the arrest of the accused, for fear they may escape punishment. But when it is desired to punish an offence like mine, which deserves honours and rewards, the custom is to proceed against the book, and to avoid attacking the author as much as possible." Upon this, she pointed out to me a very subtle distinction, which I had forgotten, in order to prove to me that it was a favour to me to issue a warrant instead of summoning me to be heard. On the following day I received a letter from Guy, in which he informed me that, having been with Monsieur le Procureur Général the same day, he had seen upon his desk the rough draft of a requisition against Émile and its author. That is, a requisitoire, a demand for surrender. Observe that the said Guy was a partner of Duchesne, who had printed the work, and also, having no anxiety on his own account, gave this information to the author out of charity. One may imagine how likely it all appeared to me. It was so simple, so natural, that a bookseller, when admitted to an audience of the Procureur Général, should quietly read the manuscripts and rough drafts scattered over his desk. Madame de Boufflers and others assured me that it was true. In consequence of the absurdities which were being continually dinned into my ears, I was inclined to believe that everybody had gone mad. Feeling sure that under all this there was some secret which was being withheld from me, I quietly awaited the issue of events, having full confidence in my upright behaviour and innocence throughout the affair, and being only too happy, whatever persecution might await me, to be summoned to the honour of suffering for the truth's sake. Far from being afraid and keeping myself concealed, I went every day to the chateau and took my usual walk in the afternoon. On the 8th of June, the day before the issue of the decree, I took it in company with two professors belonging to the oratory, Father Alamagni and Father Mandat. We took some provisions with us to Champeaux, where we enjoyed a hearty meal. We had forgotten to take glasses, and supplied their place with stalks of rye, through which we sucked the wine from the bottles, eagerly picking out the thickest stalks, in order to see which could suck the hardest. I have never been so gay in my life. I have mentioned how I suffered from sleeplessness in my youth. Since then I had accustomed myself to read in bed every night, until I found my eyes getting heavy. Then I put out my candle and tried to doze for a few minutes, which did not last long. My usual evening reading was the Bible, and in this manner I have read the whole of it through at least 5 or 6 times. On this particular evening, finding myself more wakeful than usual, I continued my reading for a longer time, and read the whole book, which ends with the history of the Levite of Ephraim, the Book of Judges, if I am not mistaken, for I have never looked at it since then. This history greatly affected me, and I was pondering over it in a half-dreamy state, from which I was suddenly roused by a noise and a light. The latter was carried by Thérèse, who was showing the way to Monsieur Laroche, who, seeing me start up abruptly, said to me, "Do not be alarmed. I come from Madame la Maréchale, who has written to you herself, and also sends you a letter from Monsieur le Prince de Conti." Inside Madame de Luxembourg's letter I found another, which had been brought to her by a special messenger from the Prince, containing the information that, in spite of all his efforts, it had been decided to proceed against me with the utmost rigour of the law. "The excitement," so he wrote, "is very great. Nothing can avert the blow. The court demands it. The Parliament wills it. At 7 o'clock tomorrow morning the warrant of arrest will be issued and executed immediately. I have obtained an assurance that, if he makes his escape, he will not be pursued, but if he persists in his wish to allow himself to be taken, then he will be arrested." La Roche besought me, in Madame de Luxembourg's name, to get up and go and consult with her. It was 2 o'clock. She had just gone to bed. "She is waiting for you," he added, "and will not go to sleep until she has seen you." I hurriedly dressed myself and hastened to her. For the first time in her life, she appeared to me agitated. Her anxiety touched me. In this moment of surprise, in the middle of the night, I myself was not free from excitement, but when I saw her I forgot myself and thought only of her and the melancholy part which she would play if I allowed myself to be taken. For while I felt that I had courage enough never to speak anything but the truth, even though it was bound to injure and ruin me, I did not feel that I had sufficient presence of mind or cleverness, or even perhaps sufficient firmness, to avoid compromising her if I was hard-pressed. This decided me to sacrifice my reputation for the sake of her peace of mind, and on this occasion to do for her that which nothing would have induced me to do for myself. The moment my mind was made up, I told her, as I did not wish to depreciate the value of my sacrifice, by allowing it to be purchased from me. I am convinced that she could not have been mistaken as to my motives, but she did not say a single word to me which showed that she appreciated them. I was so shocked at this indifference that I even hesitated whether I should not draw back. But Monsieur de Luxembourg appeared upon the scene, and Madame de Boufflers arrived from Paris a few moments afterwards. They did what Madame de Luxembourg ought to have done. I allowed myself to be flattered. I was ashamed to go back from my word, and the only question remaining was where I should go and when I should start. Monsieur de Luxembourg proposed that I should stay a few days at his house, incognito, which would give me more time to consider and decide upon my course of action. I would not agree to this, any more than to the suggestion that I should go secretly to the temple. I persisted in my intention of setting out the same day, rather than remain in concealment anywhere. Feeling that I had secret and powerful enemies in the kingdom, I thought that, in spite of my attachment for France, I ought to leave it to make sure of not being disturbed. My first impulse was to retire to Geneva, but a moment's reflection was sufficient to dissuade me from committing so great an act of folly. I knew that the French ministry, which had even greater power in Geneva than in Paris, would not leave me in peace in one of these two cities any more than in the other, if it was determined to persecute me. I knew that the Discours sur l'inégalité had aroused against me in the council a feeling of hatred, which was the more dangerous, as that body did not venture to show it openly. Lastly, I knew that when the Nouvelle Héloïse appeared, it had been eager to prohibit it, at the urgent request of Dr. Tronchin. But finding that no one imitated its example, not even in Paris, it was ashamed of its blunder and withdrew the prohibition. I had no doubt that, finding the present opportunity more favourable, it would do its best to profit by it. I knew that, in spite of all appearances, a secret jealousy prevailed against me in the hearts of all the Genovese, which only waited for an opportunity to satisfy itself. Nevertheless, patriotism called me back to my country, and if I could have ventured a hope that I could live there in peace, I should not have hesitated for a moment. But, since neither honour nor reason allowed me to take refuge there as a fugitive, I resolved only to retire to its neighbourhood, and to wait in Switzerland until I saw what course would be taken in regard to me at Geneva. It will presently be seen that this state of uncertainty did not last long. Madame de Boufflers strongly disapproved of this resolution, and made fresh efforts to persuade me to cross over to England. She did not shake my determination. I have never liked England or the English, and all the eloquence of Madame de Boufflers, far from overcoming my dislike, only seemed to increase it, without my knowing why. Being determined to set out the same day, as soon as morning came, I had already started, as far as everybody else was concerned. La Roche, whom I sent to fetch my papers, would not tell even Thérèse whether I'd left or not. Ever since I had decided some day to write the memoirs of my life, I had accumulated a number of letters and papers, so that he was obliged to make several journeys. Those papers which had already been sorted were laid aside, and I spent the rest of the morning in sorting the others, intending only to take away with me such as might be useful, and to burn the rest. Monsieur de Luxembourg was kind enough to help me in this task, which took up so much time that we were unable to finish it in the morning, and I had not time to burn anything. He offered to sort the papers which remained, and to burn the rubbish himself, without leaving anyone else to do it, and to send me all that he put aside. I accepted his offer, very glad to be freed from this anxiety, so that I might be able to spend the few hours which still remained to me, together with those who were so dear, whom I was on the point of leaving forever. He took the key of the room where I left the papers, and, at my earnest entreaty, sent for my poor aunt, who was consumed by most cruel anxiety to know what had become of me, and what was going to become of me, and was expecting the officers of justice to arrive at any moment, without knowing what she was to do or what she was to say to them. La Roche brought her to the chateau without telling her anything. She believed that I was already far away. When she saw me, she uttered a piercing cry and flung herself into my arms. Oh, friendship, union of hearts, intercourse and intimacy! During this sweet and cruel moment, all the happy, tender, and peaceful days which we had spent in company, crowding together, made me feel the more keenly the anguish of our first separation, after we had rarely lost sight of each other for a single day, during a period of nearly 17 years. Monsieur de Luxembourg, who witnessed our embrace, was unable to restrain his tears and left us alone. Thérèse did not want to leave me. I represented to her the difficulties in the way of her following me at this moment, and the necessity for her remaining to dispose of my effects and to collect my money. When a warrant of arrest is issued against a man, it is the custom to seize his papers, to set a seal upon his belongings, or to make an inventory of them, and appoint someone to take charge of them. It was very necessary that she should remain to observe what took place, and do the best she could. I promised her that she should soon rejoin me. Monsieur le Maréchal confirmed my promise. but I refused to tell her where I was going, so that, if questioned by those who came to arrest me, she might be able to declare with truth her ignorance on this point. When I embraced her at the moment of separation, I was conscious of a most singular emotion, and I said to her, with a fervour which was, alas, only too prophetic, "My child, you must arm yourself with courage. You have shared the prosperity of my happy days. It now remains for you, since you desire it, to share my misery. You must expect nothing but insults and affliction if you follow me. The lot which begins for me on this melancholy day will attend me until my last hour." Nothing further remained for me to do except to think about my departure. The officers of justice were to have arrived at 10 o'clock. It was 4 in the afternoon when I started, and they had not yet arrived. It had been settled that I should travel by the post. I had no conveyance. Monsieur le Maréchal made me a present of a cabriolet, and lent me horses and a postillion as far as the first post. A cabriolet is a light two-wheeled carriage. Where, thanks to the arrangements he had made, no difficulty was made about providing me with horses. As I had not dined at table, and had not shown myself in the chateau, the ladies came to say good-bye to me in the entresol, where I'd spent the day. Madame la Maréchale embraced me several times, with every appearance of melancholy. But I no longer perceived in her embraces the heartiness of those which she had lavished upon me 2 or 3 years before. Madame de Boufflers also embraced me and spoke very kindly to me. Madame de Mirepoix, who was present, also embraced me, which considerably surprised me. This lady is extremely cold, formal, and reserved, and, as it seems to me, not altogether free from the haughtiness which is natural to the House of Lorraine. She had never paid much attention to me, whether it was that, flattered by the unexpected honour, I was inclined to attach greater value to it, or that she really mingled with her embrace a little of that pity which is natural to generous hearts. I found in her movements and looks a certain earnestness which deeply affected me. On thinking of it afterwards, I have often suspected that she, knowing the lot to which I was condemned, had been unable to resist a momentary feeling of sympathy for my destiny. Monsieur le Maréchal did not open his mouth. He was as pale as death. He persisted in accompanying me as far as the conveyance, which was waiting for me at the watering-place. We crossed the garden without uttering a word. I had a key of the park, with which I opened the gate. After which, instead of putting it back into my pocket, I gave it to him without a word. He took it with surprising eagerness, of which I have been unable to avoid thinking frequently since then. I have rarely in my life experienced a more bitter moment than that of this separation. Our embrace was long and silent. We both felt that it was a last.